From Hitler's birthplace to Mussolini's tomb, Europe is littered with what Spanish historian José Manuel Núñez Seixas refers to as sites of dictators. These are memory sites connected to authoritarian rulers running the political spectrum from fascism to communism. How to prevent these sites from becoming pilgrimage destinations for extremists and how to use them to promote a critical understanding of the past is a challenge for governments across the continent. The challenges and approaches to sites of dictators in this episode of Realms of Memory. José Manuel Núñez Seixas is a professor of modern and contemporary history at the University of Santiago de Compostela in his native region of Galicia. His numerous books have focused on everything from regional nationalisms to fascism. It was a special request he received to chair a committee of experts to explore what to do with the former summer home of Spanish dictator Francisco Franco that led to the publication of his book, Sites of the Dictators, Memories of Authoritarian Europe, 1945 to 2020. José, welcome to Realms of Memory.
Thank you very much.
So I wanted to start with a question about how you came to this topic. You mentioned at the beginning of your book that you received an invitation in 2017 to be a part of a special committee to look into a former residence of Francisco Franco. Can you tell the story of what this was all about and how this led you to ultimately write this book that we'll be discussing?
Yes. Well, in October 2017, I just returned from 5 years lecturing at the Ludwig Maximilian University, and I came back to Galicia in Spain and to my to the University of Santiago de Compostela, and then I received a call from the regional minister of culture who proposed me to chair an expert committee, an interdisciplinary expert committee, to decide over the destiny and the uses of the former summer palace or summer residence of dictator Francisco Franco, which is located some 50 kilometers from here in the province of A Coruña, and it's called the Palace or the Manor of Meirás. This manor has quite a particular story. It was donated, in theory, by the people of Coruña in the Francoist reward in 1938 as a result of a enforced subscription. Well, there was a committee to raise funds for this donation to the dictator, and in the end, it turned out that they had not enough money. They hadn't collected enough money, so many people were forced to donate money, and some rich men also contributed to this. And so Francisco Franco received the Meirás Manor as a gift. It was his own property, and after Francisco Franco died in 1975, this was inherited first by his daughter and then by his seven grandchildren. And it continued to be the property and the private hands of this family until 2020, when the court decided to force the Franco's family to return this manor to the state, to the Spanish state. And now the discussion is, what to do with this palace? And, well, so this partly coincided then with the pandemics, and we're all locked down. And I decided to have a look on how these similar places had been addressed in all the European countries, and particularly in this ran parallel to the discussions about what to do with the Valley of the Fallen, the Valle de los Caídos, this big mausoleum war cemetery in the outskirts of Madrid. And Franco's remnants were removed from this mausoleum in November 2019. So discussing emerged what happens to these particular places which are personally and intimately linked to the personal life, to the private sphere of dictators, and which to some extent interfere with their public sphere. So I start I started looking at Italy and then looking at Germany, Austria, Portugal. And to my surprise, it turned out that particularly birthplaces, mausoleums, tombs, summer residences, private properties of dictators, both fascist dictators and para-fascist dictators, but also communist dictators, had always been a trouble, had always been a kind of a head edge for successor democracies. I mean, street names have been removed, public monuments have been removed, or streets were renamed, and many other monuments have been removed, but nobody seemed to know what to do with Oliveira Salazar's birthplace and Parenta House in Portugal, or Mussolini's birthplace in Italy, or even Hitler's birthplace, I mean, the house where he was born in Braun am Inn in Austria. So I found out that there was no general reflection about these very particular sites of memory, and I allow myself to coin a proper term, which could be the sites of the dictators. I mean, these places where the private and the public interfere, where the private dimension and the private life of dictators and their the public appearances and the public profile interfere and were deeply intertwined. So in a way, after the death of dictators, their ghost, their spirit, their ghost seem to be very alive in these particular places. And usually successor democracies, even in countries where fascism had been defeated in 1945, successor democracies didn't know actually how to address these places out of different reasons.
So you're almost trying to build a legal case for what to do, because the provisional government, this is a committee put together right by the provisional government, and they want to try to make a case about how they can expropriate this residence that's still in the possession of the Francisco Franco's family. There's no legal precedent for this, so you're really looking around Spain and in Europe to see, well, what, how else, what's being done with these types of sites of memory linked to the personal biography of these dictators. And what you're finding is just confusion everywhere. There isn't a clear line to follow. But I mean, in the end, at least in this particular case, you are part, I mean, the committee does help the provisional government make a case that it can lay claim to that,
yeah,
that residence.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a law professor. I'm not a law historian. But obviously, the bulk of the committee was composed of lawyers. And they found a way to find arguments for an expropriation or a kind of expropriation. And I mean, our first conclusion was everywhere confusion reigned. Every country had followed its own path. And some countries like Austria even passed specific laws for dealing with Hitler's sites of memory, while in others like Italy or even the post-Soviet countries, there was no legislation at all. I mean, everything was more or less improvised. And in this sense, we tried to follow our own path, so to speak, to go our own way, which in the end is what almost every country has done. I have to say, obviously, my outlook is not that of a lawyer, it's not that of a law historian. I was just interested in seeing how public conversation had been, whether there were more patterns which could be followed, which could be deduced from the comparative analysis of different cases. And so my conclusion was, in the beginning, there was silence. Then some local authorities, but also local entrepreneurs and memory activists at the local level raised the question of what to do with Hitler's house, what to do with Salazar's house, what to do with Mussolini's tomb, mausoleum. And then the discussion was spread nationwide, and the national parliaments discussed how to deal with these places. And the interesting thing here is that the approach taken by local politicians, by local entrepreneurs, and also locally based memory activists was always more pragmatic, while the approach taken by national authorities or national parliaments was always based on strong principles. And I always remember a statement made by Prelapios, I mean Mussolini's birthplace, by Prelapios' mayor, who was a post-communist, Frassinetti, who simply replied to some deputies at the Italian parliament, well, you know, you are discussing about how to prevent tourists, dark tourists, from traveling, from coming to Prelapio, and you don't realize they are already coming. I mean, simply, internet is full of references to Mussolini, to Hitler, and dark tourists have a lot of references and guidance. So our job, our task, is at least to make the presence of neo-fascists or people who are nostalgic of the dictatorship, to make their presence uncomfortable and to give visitors appropriate information in order to set the context of what they are visiting.
You mentioned dark tourism, and I mean, clearly you did this, you were part of this committee to look into what to do with this residence, and there's no precedent. But the bigger question is, well, who cares? Like, why does this matter? And in the Italian case, you're mentioning, well, they're dark. There are people that are going to these sites for dark tourist reasons, and there are people going for lots of other reasons that aren't necessarily a healthy thing for democracy. And so I don't know, could you elaborate on that? Because this really gets into what's at stake. I mean, what's at stake that so you don't have any kind of coherent policy, you're looking across Europe for how other countries are dealing with these sites of memory connected to the personal biography of former dictators. Maybe it's being legislated, maybe it's being improvised, maybe there's a disconnect between what's happening locally, what's happening at the national level. But there is a shared concern that something has to be done. I mean, if you look at the case of the committee that you were on, I mean, there's this Francisco Franco Family Foundation, right, that wants to turn that manor into a site of reverence. They want to celebrate that past. So clearly that's something the locals are up in arms about. There's a lot of concern that this has to be addressed. So I was hoping, could you elaborate on why this matters? Why do you need to draw attention to it? What's at stake?
As I mentioned before, I mean, what I observe in almost all countries is that at the beginning there is silence and indifference, and even ignorance about where a dictator was born, what's the destiny or the social use of his or her, well, his birthplace, or where is he buried. And in the second phase, obviously, but after two generations, usually there is a new sensitivity towards the past and towards uncomfortable past. And many societies, this happened in Spain, but also in Italy, in Germany, ask themselves the question, what to do with these remnants, with these vestiges of the past dictatorships. And at this point, there is local mobilization on the one hand by memory activists who want to remove or at least resignify these sites of memory linked to the dictators, while on the other hand, there is a pragmatic approach taken by local entrepreneurs and local authorities, mayors, municipalities, which try to reorient resignified these sites of memory and become aware of the necessity of re-educating I mean, not only the locals, but also the tourists. I mean, giving them proper information, because otherwise these places are always taken, or more or less taken, by dark tourists. Obviously, the concept of dark tourism is a very discussed one, because there are many kinds of dark tourists. You have nostalgists, you have people who are actually followers of the dictators for political reasons, but also for, let's say, aesthetic reasons, etc. There are also some freaks, some people who simply like movies and war movies and video games and these kind of things. And then there are many historians. I mean, high school, from university professors to high school teachers, who actually travel to, I don't know, Georgia and want to see the place where Stalin was born, or travel to Romania and want to see Ceausescu's palace. This is also dark tourism. I mean, not every kind of dark tourism is potentially a danger for democracy. And then the discussion usually becomes nationwide. I mean, at the national level, general principles are used, and this is intertwined with more general questions. For instance, in Italy, discussion was, well, we don't still have a national museum of the resistance or a national museum of Mussolini's period. So this museum should be located in Rome or in Milan rather than in Predapio, which is far away, and you have to take a couple of buses and there is no highway, etc. And the same happened in Portugal. I mean, the idea is, if people have to go, have to move to remote places, just only those people who are especially motivated by political reasons will go there. And in both in Portugal, in Italy, and even in Austria, discussion came to a kind of impasse. I mean, there is no, they're not moving forward.
So throughout your book, I think what you're getting at is this where question, right? Where you have these sites of memory, and what to do with them or how concerned you should be about them is tied into this where question, right? If they're located in a place that's hard to get to, where you really don't have to worry about them being a center of gravity for whatever kind of tourism might generate, then not too much of an issue. But if they're not that hard to get to, and they are drawing in numbers of people, then it becomes more of a concern. And not just because of the numbers of people, but because of the type of memory, I think, that could be associated with it. And here I want to get to your point about charisma. And I think you set this up at the beginning of your book, that what is special about these dictators is they're not descended from a line of some kind of royal line. They're self-made people. And you know, you point out that they may die in a palace, but they weren't born in a palace. And the essence of their power has to do with their charisma. And this is something in English where you think, oh, charismatic, that's just somebody who's charming, captivating, and it doesn't have any maybe dark connotation to it. But there's a political understanding of what charisma means, tied into the history of these dictators. So could you elaborate on what do you mean by charisma? How is charisma tied into these sites? How does charisma get perpetuated? And then especially at places that are closely tied into maybe where that person was born, where they died?
Well, that's a very good question. It was, actually, I am using charisma in the sense coined by Max Weber in 1924, when he wrote that some charisma was a kind of legitimacy that did not emerge from democratic endorsement, which it did not emerge either from a dynasty or a historical connection to a past, but it also was simply due to special reasons, the special ability of an individual, for a political leader, to develop, to generate attraction by in his followers. And obviously, charisma was not understood in the positive sense of being charming, but in a way, charisma also means some kind of charm. Obviously, charisma, this is also Max Weber insisted on, is not usually enough. You may lose your charisma after you are in office and you have to take decisions and you are ruling for a number of years, but then you use traditional sources of legitimacy which may reinforce charisma, like particularly historical legitimacy and nationalism. And then charisma can also be more or less built from above as a result of propaganda campaigns, etc. If we think about Stalin, or we think about Mao Zedong, or we think about Joseph Tissue, they were not particularly attractive people. They were not particularly good speakers. Their charisma was an elaboration from state propaganda, but many people believe it. And many people were actually imbued with the idea or belief that these dictators had some, let's say, special powers, and even the as inherited or similar to that, to the powers of saints. They were a kind of secularized saints. And the thing is that charisma cannot be inherited by the sons or the successors of dictators. And usually in these cases, charisma dies with the dictator, and which is opposed to what happens with dynasties and with monarchies, where you have the two bodies of the king, and there's always the legitimacy which is transferred. And I think what makes the difficulty of dealing with these sides of memory, with these sides of dictators, is the fact that charisma continues to be present. It's a kind of ghost, which, or at least there is the fear on the part of the authorities that this charisma is still alive. And particularly in places where you realize, well, this guy was one of us because he was not born in a palace. He was the son of a shoemaker like Stalin. And then you are in front of his tomb, on his grave, and then you see, oh, well, poor guy, he's dead. And usually the first reaction is to feel compassion. So I think this is what makes the management of these sides of dictators so difficult for the authorities. And this is why they pose a number of dilemmas for democratic governments.
So if you're a self-made dictator, you don't have this dynastic legitimacy. You establish your connection to the people through charisma. And you don't even necessarily have to be a great speaker to do that. So however that connection comes about, it's this powerful attachment. Maybe you could argue that it's maybe produces a group think even. It might even strip the individualism away from people. And this is something that can live on even after the death of the dictator. And I think one of your points is that if you have a site that's very closely connected to that person, precisely because they come from an ordinary background, you risk humanizing or maybe casting that person just as a regular person and losing sight of what happened because of that charisma. What were the consequences of that?
Well, the consequences of that is that new generations, which are more or less ignorant about historical facts, and this is particularly happens after the second, the third generation, which have no memory families of what a dictator, what a dictatorship was, or what life in a dictatorship was, may simply feel attracted by these remnants of charisma, or simply by this idea that dictators were people like us, were ordinary people from ordinary background. Obviously, this is in a way, they reproduce some of the patterns that characterized the reproduction of charismatic dictatorships. I mean, the idea that you don't know what the dictator is doing. The dictator is far away from your reach. You simply get what propaganda is saying, what propaganda is diffusing about the qualities of this dictator. But what you perceive is the management and the bad government of mayors, of local authorities, policemen, etc. So you can criticize them because you know what they do, but you always believe in the idealized the image you receive from the person on the top, I mean, the dictator. This also happened in the monarchies in the 17th and 16th century. You know, it's long life to the king and death to bad government. But in a way, this happens. Obviously, there is a lot of information available for new generations, and we could think that critical thinking and a more balanced view should be possible. However, what we see is that once people are getting in touch in the family memories of a dictatorship, the more they lose, let's say, this family memory, the more they believe some very, non-historically grounded, not historically balanced accounts. So in a way, if these sites of memory are not re-signified correctly in a proper way and to simply show how dictatorships were and showing who were the victims of the dictators and which were the mechanisms of the power, we risk that these places become actually, sites of pilgrimage instead of sites of memory.
Okay. So among these sites of dictators that are associated with their personal biography, prominently featured in your book are birthplaces or childhood homes. So you mentioned there isn't any organized approach. If you're looking across Europe, it's different in every place. Sometimes there's a difference between the locality where the places are and what the national government is doing. But could you talk about a few examples of how these birthplaces or childhood homes are managed differently, and maybe how their management might change over time?
Well, I mean, the most famous case is perhaps Hitler's birthplace. I mean, the house where he was born. It was on the second floor of a house in Braunau am Inn, which is a town on the border between Austria and Bavaria in Germany, and where actually the Hitler family stayed for a couple of weeks. I mean, now there's a local historian who has issued a book where he underlines that Hitler's family lived there for 5 weeks. Okay. Hitler had no personal memories of this house, even when he passed this house in 1938. Well, this house was then sold to another owner, and this owner came out to be one of the few Nazi leaders who were active in Braunau am Inn. And then after the Anschluss, I mean, the SA took over the house, and it was transformed into a museum. The Americans, 1945, when they occupied Austria, turned this house into a museum of the horrors of Nazism. I mean, how they devoted it to the victims of National Socialism. And then the house was returned to the former owner, and then it was leased to the Austrian state. The Austrian state decided to cede it to pass it to the municipality. And the municipality actually found a very good solution, which was to transform the Hitler's birthplace into a school, a kind of school for disabled people. And this lasted until the 1990s, when there was a number of issues. And then the owner, they didn't want to renew the lease contract. And a public discussion emerged, first on the local level and then on the national level. And there were, on the one hand, memory activists who wanted to transform Hilda's house into a house of responsibility, into a museum devoted to peace and to promote mutual understanding among peoples and nations, while local entrepreneurs wanted to erase any memory of Hitler in this town. And in the end, it was the Austrian state which took over, and the Austrian parliament passed a specific law and to expropriate this house. And now this house, a couple of years ago, a final decision was taken. There was an experts committee, and the final decision was taken. In other words, that the house should become a police headquarter. I mean, you may ask, why a police headquarter? And it was because it was the only way to prevent neo-Nazis, particularly demonstrations of radical right or far right activists, from demonstrating in front of the house. I mean, the main issue for the Austrian authorities, as well as for German authorities in other cases, was to get away, so to speak, to prevent these places from becoming pilgrimage centers. Obviously, it has raised a parallel discussion. Okay, this is in a way also a kind of forgetting, because I mean, some people also defend, also held the view that the building had to be removed, completely removed, and then it was a form of oblivion as well. And the opposite case is Italy, when you have Predappio, when you have the birthplace of Mussolini, a mausoleum tomb, and Mussolini's tomb. I mean, the vault, the family vault, has a very salient place in Predappio Cemetery. And three times a year, there are demonstrations of neo-fascist activists who go across the town, and these guys in fascist uniforms, black shirts, etc., and give homage publicly and openly to the memory of the Duce. And local discussion emerged about what to do with Mussolini's birthplace, with a parallel building which was built in the 1930s, which was the fascist house, and all the buildings which were also designed to be to remind visitors of the fact that Predappio was the birthplace of the Duce, and which were, they are still standing there, and nobody knows what to do with them. And the discussion was whether to place a museum of fascism in Predappio. And this so-called Mussolini Museum shouldn't actually give an uncritical or apologetic view of Mussolini's life, but rather a very critical and informed view of the crimes committed by fascism, both in Italy and outside Italy, of the characteristics of the fascist regime. But in the end, the discussion came to a dead end. And Mussolini's family right now is very happy with the new mayor of Predappio, who is more or less close to the post-neo-fascist. And last news I heard is that the last updates I have on this going in the direction that a museum of regional history will be created. Obviously, there are plenty of examples. I mean, Georgia is a very fascinating one, because Georgia has erased any memory of the Soviet rule. I mean, Soviet rule is considered to be, from 1921 to 1989, a period of foreign rule, full stop. There are memories of national history in Georgia which have almost erased any trace of Soviet period. But the great exception is Gori, the birthplace of Stalin, because Stalin is still considering interviews in opinion polls to be by the majority of the Georgian population to be the most universal Georgian who has ever existed. So in Gori, you visit the Stalin Museum, and you see a rather uncritical, you can appreciate how a rather uncritical view of Stalin is offered. I mean, from a reproduction of his birthplace, the house where he was born, to the many gifts he received as a head of state, and just very recently a room devoted to, an exhibition room devoted to the victims of Stalinism has been added. There is a big statue of Stalin in front of the museum, and this particular place receives a lot of visitors. Nowadays, many Chinese, as far as I know, a lot of visitors who simply are attracted by the fact that Gori is the birthplace of Stalin. And local entrepreneurs, local population, seem not to care about it. I mean, they are not voting for the Georgian Communist Party at all. They are not in favor of the return to Stalin times, but still, they consider that Stalin belonged to their history, and they make some profit out of it.
That's fascinating. So you mentioned three different examples, and you're finishing with Gori, where Stalin is born in Georgia, right? And pointing out how there's a museum there that goes back to Soviet times, the museum, and still celebrates that past. He's a source of local pride, maybe not because of the repressions, but because of the international standing he achieved for the Soviet Union. So you might want to remember somebody because of a source of pride, and maybe because of tourist dollars. He's bringing in tourists from as far away as that town is drawing tourists from as far away as China. And you mentioned other cases like Brunau am Inn in Austria, where Hitler is born. In that place, it seems like it's a source of shame. I mean, if anything, the town wants to bury that history, and it takes a long time for there to be any kind of commemorative marker on the building. To me, it seemed like only after a certain period of time, fairly late in the day, it's the mayor of the town that puts a monument that itself is kind of like an obscure thing. It's not really making a direct reference to Hitler, but it's referring to this authoritarian past, and that triggers a larger memory conversation. And if anything, in Brunau, it seems like the town is coming around to dealing with that past. And they do eventually deal with it in other ways, you point out. But it's the national government that seems like it puts a lid on the whole thing and decides to take that house and neutralize it, turn it into a police station so you don't have to worry about the wrong kind of people going there. So to me, it seemed like there was a tension between the direction the town wanted to go in and what the national government eventually does. And in the case of Pradapio, where Mussolini's grave is, and where you point out that Mussolini himself totally transformed that town, invested a huge amount of money and resources into that community, it seems like the Italian government is just turning the other way. I mean, there is a influx of neo-fascists. There's a huge tourist industry, people that are cashing in on selling memorabilia, and it's drawing lots of people, maybe less and less over time. And there are laws on the books against those kinds of public displays in support of fascism, but the Italian government is not really doing anything about it. And at the end of the day, you have a mayor who seems supportive of a memory museum devoted to that past, but as soon as he's out of power and a conservative mayor comes in, then it's a change of politics at the local level. It seems like that kind of is the end of that, any possibility that you'll have a museum there.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think it will be so. Neo-fascists are not that powerful in present-day Meloni's government, at least not neo-fascists in the old style. I think which there is a direction in the new Italian government regarding memory politics to re-emphasize the memories of Italian victimhood in the Second World War at the hands of Yugoslav partisans, etc. But they are not particularly interested in resurrecting Mussolini's ghost. I think they want to simply turn this page and to move on. And at the same time, they are quite afraid and they are questioning, they're quite afraid of the use of anti-fascist, let's say, memory. And they are questioning the anti-fascist metrics of the Italian Republic. I mean, obviously, Italy, like many other Western European countries, after 1945, reinvented their democratic legitimacy on the foundation on upon a newly constructed anti-fascist myth. I mean, the idea we were all anti-fascists and fascism was just a thing by or a strange thing imposed on us by a minority of bad connationals. Or about the fellow, a minority of crazy people who were not true Germans, true Italians, etc. Or in other countries, they simply denied the existence of collaboration, which was not a minority phenomenon, which was quite a larger phenomenon, as it has been demonstrated in the case of France, etc. But that's another story, obviously. And I think this is also another reason why these sides of the dictators also represented, on the one hand, an uncomfortable memory of the authoritarian Europe, but also, on the other hand, they offer us a very good angle, to observe and to analyze from a different perspective the evolution of memory politics in post-war Europe.
Hmm. Yeah, that part I thought was fascinating, that if you're looking at these sites of memory, they're set within a national memory context, and they raise lots of uncomfortable questions. Whether you're in Austria and you've got a history of a country that wants to remember itself as the victim of German occupation, and once you start opening the door to that past, that maybe you've got to start looking at it from other angles. Or in Italy, that wants to remember overthrowing Mussolini, remember the resistance, not remember the extent to which the Italian people were supportive of Mussolini. And of course, France is a very, very similar history.
The fact that there was a civil war in northern Italy between 43 and 1945. Or even in the Austrian case, the fact that they have the bad dictator, who was Hitler, but then they also have Dollfuss, who is considered by many not to have been a dictator, by many Austrians, particularly by conservative Austrians. He also became a symbol of the Nazi occupation because he had been killed by Nazi activists in 1934, although he was a para-fascist, at least an authoritarian president, who suspended constitutional rights, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and I think that's a point that you make in a number of instances, that if you're an authoritarian ruler, but you're seen as somebody that is taking a stand in defense of your country, you could be the founder of your country, you could be defending its independence, then there's a much more forgiving approach to how you remember that person.
Yeah. Well, this is what happened not only in Austria, obviously, but also happens in Slovakia, in the post-93 Slovakia, where Joseph Tiso has been sometimes remembered as the founder of the first president of a Slovak state in history, although this state was a puppet state, actually, of the Nazis. Or you have the same phenomenon in Croatia with Ante Pavelic, or you also have the same phenomenon in the Baltic countries, particularly in Estonia and in Latvia, where their presidents, who were authoritarian presidents, who were also to some extent influenced by fascism and by authoritarian right-wing authoritarian currents, have been remembered after 91 as victims of Soviet occupation, as defenders of Latvian, Estonian nationhood.
Okay. So to go back to your point about charisma, you point out, is connected to the person of the dictator, and it can live on even after that person dies. But if charisma is going to be at its most significant, most relevant, it's at the gravesite of that person. You feature a number of burial sites, and even in cases where there is no burial site, you point out that there people manage to find alternative graves, people that can stand in and substitute for the absent dictator. So that part I thought was fascinating. And again, in some cases, very different approaches for how you deal with those burial sites. Of course, most prominently in the case of Spain, you point out there's no easy solution for how to deal with this. Even after you remove the dictator, there's no easy solution to how you deal with that site.
Yeah, well, actually, the Valley of the Fallen is a very particular case in Europe because it is three times in one, the three things in one thing. I mean, the Valley of the Fallen was a mausoleum of a dictator. Now the body of the dictator has been removed, and obviously it has ceased to be that. But it's also a huge war cemetery. I mean, almost 60,000 corpses are buried there. And it is also a great monument to Franco's victory in 1939. I mean, the whole area is presided over by a huge cross. And the symbology and the bas reliefs, etc., all refers to Franco's mythology and to Franco's symbols of power. How to re-signify this is a great challenge. And I'm afraid the Spanish state, I'm quite connected to the decision makers in this respect, and they are still confused about what path should they follow, because there are no models at all. And, well, in the case of the Meiras Manor, things will probably be easier. I mean, there's a pre-Franco's memory of that place, which was linked to a very famous Spanish female writer, Emilia Pardo Bazán, and a combination of both types of memories, a literary memory before Franco times, and then a site of memory of the Franco's dictatorship is possible. In some of the cases, you're right, the management of these sites of memory has become much more complicated. In Germany, they were lucky enough not to have the body of the dictator. I mean, we already know the story. The Soviets simply buried the corpses under a military barrack in Magdeburg, and then they threw the ashes to a river, etc. They had coffins, but not corpses. I mean, for instance, the bunker of the chancellery. And in some cases, it was quite interesting how Hitler's nostalgists and neo-Nazi activists have looked for other graves. Heydrich's, for instance, Reinhard Heydrich's grave in Berlin, or after his death, Rudolf Hess' family grave in Wunsiedel in Bavaria, or Hitler's parents' grave in close to Linz. However, German authorities, also Austrian authorities, have taken effective and efficient measures to delay any trace of Fascist memory in these sites, and they particularly have been motivated by the fear to allow pilgrimage centers to consolidate on German or Austrian territory in a very pragmatic way. I mean, for instance, Rudolf Hess' grave was removed overnight, and Hitler's parents' grave was also removed, and no explanations were given. And I mean, with this type of measures, discussion was over. In other countries, however, decisions have taken longer, and they were always confronted with the dilemmas of resignifying or destroying or simply leaving as it was, or simply keeping these sets of memory in their as they stood there. Leaving them untouched, so to speak. I mean, the case in Portugal, for instance, is very interesting as well, because you simply have birthplace, Salazar's birthplace. Portugal is a Portuguese democracy. It's based on post-revolutionary consensus after 1974, a general rejection of the dictatorial past. However, there are some dark sides. I mean, the forgetting about the colonial past on the one hand, and also forgetting about Salazar's birthplace and sites of memory. I mean, they are quite far away in a very rural area. Nobody seemed to care about it. But once discussion emerged about what to do with that building, with that house, and whether a Salazar Museum should be open, then you have all discussions of the 1970s returning, and you have a parallel story to that of Italy.
Okay. So I'm asking these questions from the United States in a country that still can't disagree over what to do with Civil War monuments. So, I mean, I was going to ask you a question about, is it a question of time? Is it a question of just giving democracies enough time to mature, and after a certain number of decades, that they'll find ways to deal with this past in a more mature, more critical way that'll be supportive of their democracies? Or is it just impossible to generalize in that way?
Well, I would say this is impossible to generalize, and I think each society finds its own path. You know, there are a certain discussion memory studies over the last decade, whether actually memory politics or public politics of remembrance make any sense in the present day world, when people simply are informed through TikTok videos or social networks, etc., and school or even the TV or radio don't have any more a central role. I believe there are no general patterns, and each society finds in its own way to, and also that societies have the right to remember, have to some extent obligation to remember and to remind citizens of their uncomfortable past, but they also have the right to forget and to be selective regarding what they damn to oblivion and what not. I mean, I'm not that familiar with the case of the United States and particularly the memories of the Civil War. But, I mean, obviously each country has many uncomfortable memories. I'm also thinking about Native American peoples and the Sioux Wars and the special areas where Native Americans lived, etc., or wars with Mexico or occupation of Haiti, of Saint Domingue, etc. Obviously, we have now, when looking backwards, the question always arises: how far back should we, or how far back should we look? Because obviously, in Spain, then we have the question of colonialism, not only the colonial wars in the 19th and particularly 20th centuries, but also it is a matter of some discussion in Spain every month of October, when the 12th of October is commemorated, whether Spain should apologize for its colonization of Central and South America in the 16th century. And some people say yes, some other people say no, it hasn't. It has nothing to do with us. I mean, we will apologize when the Romans apologized for conquering Hispania the second century or the third century before Christ, etc., etc. In the end, it's a kind of, you know, endless discussion. So in the American case, I would say American society will find in some way, I have the impression that this memory of the Civil War of is much more alive in some places than in many others. I mean, when I was in California, for instance, as a guest professor, I don't remember anyone or any monument discussing about the Civil War. However, there was a particular sensitivity towards the Spanish presence in California in the 16th century or the past confrontations with Mexico. And I guess from Boston or from Massachusetts, the perspective is a very different one.
José, thank you so much for taking time to talk to me, especially during your weekend and during your early evening. Really appreciate it.
I thank you very much for this conversation. I hope it was useful for the listeners, and apologize whether my English in some respects is a bit baroque, but anyway, I guess you are accustomed to it.
José Manuel Núñez Seixas is a professor of modern and contemporary history at the University of Santiago de Compostela in Galicia, Spain. I've been talking with him about his book, Sites of the Dictators, Memories of Authoritarian Europe, 1945 to 2020. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, tell a friend or family member. The best endorsement is word of mouth. I'm Rick Dedarian. See you soon.